A Google News search reveals these headlines this week. Keep the holy in holidays. My personal war on Christmas. A history of the war on Christmas. Islam's war on Christmas. The Republican war on Christmas. The Democrat war on Christmas. Opening new fronts of war on Christianity. Catholic Church sues DC Metro for blocking seasonal ad. Is a protester holding an all holiday sign, all holidays matter sign? I don't think that got there. And then, are Jesus' birth and the Bible fake news? Atheists unveil billboard challenging virgin birth and talking snakes. That's my favorite one. For me, these headlines could all read the same. We are a country divided. I've been thinking a lot about that as we end a year marked by division, polarization, and demonization of the other. Certainly, religious, ethical, and ideological differences are at the heart of this division. I've gone in searching for answers. Why? And I found some in Arlie Russell Hochschild's excellent book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. It came out this past year. In it, the author explores the people of an area of Louisiana who believe they are marginalized by flat or falling wages, rapid demographic change, and a liberal culture that mocks their faith and patriotism. As the New York Times said, when she asks a small town mayor to describe his politics in this book, his first two issues, or is it one in his mind, are welfare and race. I don't like the government paying unwed mothers to have a lot of kids, and I don't go for affirmative action. Reverse class anger is more potent than ever. Liberals have long wondered why working class voters support policies that the liberals think hurt the working class. Why would victims of pollution side with the polluters? While Hochschild can point to certain types of media and politicians that bait voters with particular social issues, she sees this group of people who believe others have cut in line in front of them as most motivated by the kind of giddy emotional release that the current atmosphere in American politics provides them. Now, none of the people Hochschild speaks with seem to be directly affected by competition from people of color or others they claim have cut in line in front of them. In fact, it is unchecked corporate greed and power and technological transformation who are the real enemy of these folks. But there's no denying that demographic and cultural change have robbed these people, mostly white men, of the status they once enjoyed. A Hochschild acknowledges their pain even as she denounces their bigotry and laments the division that plagues us all. And so here we find ourselves, beginning another season of supposed merriment and joy, one that looks toward the closing of another year. And yet, if all this is true, if there is a sort of cultural war going on in our collective American psyche, we saw the echoes of that war in those War on Christmas headlines, one that includes tensions of race, class, gender, and so on, it can be tough to think how we will go forward in this upcoming year. As I do when I struggle for ideas in our present time, I feel that invitation to look for inspiration in the past. And so I invite you to come with me for a moment to Egypt, Alexandria to be precise, to the year 185 CE. And around this time, a man named Origen was born. Now, raised in a Christian home, Origen's father, Leonidas, sent him to the best teachers in town. He had his son memorize scripture every day. And at 17 years old, under the reign of Septimius Severus, the persecution against Christians was unleashed in Alexandria. Now, this contrasts with the United States today, because back then in Egypt, there was indeed a real war on Christians. But the division among people, those echoes we find today. In 202, Leonidas went to prison for his faith. Ultimately, he was martyred, his property confiscated, leaving his family destitute. But Origen carried on, drawing upon the education given to him by his father to teach the Greek language and copy manuscripts for a living. At 18, he was even made head of a church school, where he became an expert in learning how to refute arguments against Christianity, all the while continuing to help those who, like his father, were imprisoned for their faith. Now, Origen was a scholar. He was a thinker far, far ahead of his time, learning Hebrew to assist his study of Hebrew scripture, a rarity in the pre-Reformation world. He was also a prolific writer, his first work being entitled On First Principles, remarkable as the first systematic theology ever written. He found three levels of meaning in scripture through his reasoned interpretation, the literal, the moral, and the allegorical, shaping the larger theological conversation that would come ever after. Writing at a time when there were multiple incarnations of Christianity all around and the church was still defining its basic doctrines, Origen helped lay the groundwork for centuries of future theological thought. But, and here's where we start getting to the real you part, he held positions that were eventually condemned as heretical by later church councils. In 231 and 232, church councils enacted motions against him and excommunicated him. Forced to flee, Origen found refuge in Palestine and Arabia, and during a third century persecution, pagans threw this still devout Christian into prison. Tortured and condemned to die, only the death of the emperor Decius saved him from execution. But Origen's health was broken. He was close to 70 when he died in around 253, 254, cast out by many, both Christian and non-Christian. So what was considered heretical by these early church councils? Like the Unitarians who would follow him in the centuries to come, Origen's scholarly study of the scriptures led him to doubts about the historicity of critical sections of scripture, as well as concluding that Jesus was not raised from the dead in a physical body. Even more important for Unitarian Universalist historians, Origen believed that in the end, everyone would be saved. The first written origins of an idea known, of course, as Universalism. So we often think of Origen as the very first Unitarian Universalist because he held both ideas and wrote them down. Like later Universalists to follow him, the people of Origen's time were considered and concerned about the motivation to do good without the threat of hell hanging over humankind. Origen spoke of this process of finding our best selves when he said it would come, quote, slowly and gradually, seeing that the process of amendment and correction will take place imperceptibly in the individual instances during the lapse of countless and unmeasured ages, some outstripping others, and tending by a swifter course towards perfection, while others again follow close at hand, and some again a long way behind. So in other words, the path to a place of ultimate goodness is a slow one that will vary from person to person. So we have Origen. We have Origen to thank for beginning to tease out the ideas of Universalism, that ultimate reconciliation with divine love, that idea that has now evolved for us into the idea that all human beings are worthy, inherently worthy, our first principle. And at this time, we find ourselves poised on the brink of the usual holiday tensions, magnified this year by the tensions and divisions in our country and our world. What better time to consider where we as a faith tradition come from, our origin, and how we got here? The question is, how do we draw upon our origins as a faith tradition in order to meet the demands of today? At this time of year, I believe that progressive people of conscience can tap into this concept of universal love, this universalism, and begin the peacemaking process both in our own lives and in the larger world. Now, as some of you may know, in the past year, I completed a master's degree in interfaith action. And I felt called to participate in this because while the term interfaith may conjure up images of Muslims and Christians and Jews, obvious Muslims and Christians and Jews sitting around a table together, the reality is that virtually every encounter we have nowadays is interfaith, even in this very room. It's less obviously so than that image of people sitting around a table who are obviously of different faiths. More and more people all over the world are living in communities with those who believe differently than them. Globalization has provided many opportunities to be part of different religious traditions. And for even those who don't claim a particular tradition, the mixture of cultural assumptions and ethics are often based in these kind of invisible religious roots and assumptions. Wherever we go, we're not getting away from religion or religious differences. They're there. So just think of all those people in that book, Strangers in Their Own Land. Those people Hochschild spoke about who live in Louisiana. But, I mean, truthfully, their world might as well be a different planet than ours here in Fullerton, California. So different do the conclusions they have come to seem to be as compared to ours. We must indeed navigate across multiple lines of identity if we are to begin to heal this rift. And so for me, the characteristics then of interfaith work, both on the micro and the macro scale, become increasingly necessary to heal this divided world. So what are we invited to do? Well, as Unitarian Universalists, we can look back to a figure like Origen with that early conception of universalism and be inspired, hopefully, to take action in today's world. With this community's varying identities as atheists, agnostics, and theists, that concept of ultimate reconciliation is one we can no longer be content to leave with God. We as human beings must ensure that reconciliation grounded in love is available to all right here on earth. So how do we do that? Well, one way is for us to consider ourselves as interfaith peacemakers, either formally or informally. One avenue for peacemaking that I've studied is what is called faith-based diplomacy. The International Center for Religion and Diplomacy defines this as being rooted in religions, their texts, their practices, their traditions, and the two-vectored spiritual orientation around which all of them revolve. First, the proper orientation of politics to the transcendent, and second, the active role of the divine in human affairs. Practitioners of faith-based diplomacy will, to be sure, draw upon secular expertise in conflict resolution and analysis, political science and philosophy, experience in national security, diplomacy, community development, and the like, but their central orientating compass is their faith. So that's a lot to take in. But in other words, by utilizing these principles in religious conflicts, one is essentially speaking the same language as the participants. That concept of translation I spoke of in last week's sermon about the stages of faith development. Now, admittedly, religious differences abound among and within faith traditions about the meaning of reconciliation and about the relative roles of punishment, forgiveness, apology, atonement, and the practice of these concepts. But still, reconciliation is important in each tradition, even with those variations in definition. So spiritual principles as a foundation for the peacemaking process, that can ground that process in the very foundation that most religious people are coming from themselves. It acknowledges the spiritual dimension that is part of the conflict already and even embraces it as a tool for reconciliation. So for we Unitarian Universalists, this process invites us to really explore what it means to approach peacemaking from a faith-based perspective. Do we ground ourselves in that concept of universalism, that ultimate reconciliation, that affirmation of human worth and dignity that Origen spoke of? Or perhaps it is the rationalist and scholarly order of the early Unitarians that sustains us, that grounds us as we try to reach across divisions. Maybe it's the large multi-faith umbrella that Unitarian Universalists claim today, that gives us the empathy needed to deftly move across differences. So we have multiple options. In Strangers in Their Own Land, Hochschild engaged in what I will call spiritual conversations. And I invite you to have these with people. These are discussions that engage leaders in conversations of the heart, in which they share what they have suffered, the friends, loved ones, career hopes, property they may have lost, their hatred or resignation or hopefulness about these losses, their dreams for the future, and the place of the divine in all of these matters. So how they see this from a theological framework. Conversations of this nature offer the reconciliation process a level of engagement that is deeper than what is sometimes focused on in conflict resolution. Can you imagine going deeper at the holiday dinner table with your family, with that sibling you never get along with? It's hard. It's hard to cross that bridge. But rather than focusing on analytical concerns and facts, who's right, who's wrong, spiritual conversations are an opportunity to really get down to where people's beliefs are centered. Hochschild couldn't be more different than the people she documents in her book. She's a Berkeley sociologist. She's a liberal. She has ostensibly little in common with these people from rural Louisiana, but these spiritual conversations with their inherent intimacy leads her to the conclusion that she, gasp, actually likes these people. They're not simply soldiers in a class war, but they're victims too. She laments their economic losses and finds opportunities to praise the grit and resilience they exhibit. Finally, in this peacemaking process, the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy talks about the importance of creating a moral vision, a set of foundational values centered upon reconciliation and informed by a divinely grounded understanding of politics. Through examining their own suffering and their community's suffering, and then through a learning conversation, participants come to embrace the principles as relevant ones for their world. Again, as in the case of spiritual conversations, developing a moral vision offers participants the opportunity to go deeper in the reconciliation process. It offers those in dialogue a chance to discover their commonalities in their moral outlook for the future. Both spiritual conversations and moral vision offer participants a level of engagement that transcends everyday logistical conversations or debates. They provide chances for people to see the humanity of those they are engaging with. And that's the challenge. Recently, I found myself seated next to a stranger at a fundraising dinner for a nonprofit that serves people from a wide variety of economic and social spheres. And I got that dreaded question I get from time to time. What do you do? This stranger asked. It's a loaded question, I've discovered, especially if you're on a plane. That can be an uncomfortable 2 or 3 hours. I'm a minister, I said at last. My congregation is in Fullerton. Ah, she said. And do you believe in Jesus? She was pretty confident she knew the answer. My pause, however, gave her pause. A million things went through my mind. How to answer that? I believe Jesus was a great teacher, I said finally. Her face turned to stone. She nodded once, brusquely. I had clearly failed in answering that question correctly. And we said nothing else during the rest of that dinner. It was a long dinner. But I've wondered since then. I was tired. I have a lot of excuses why that conversation didn't go further. But I've wondered since then, what would have happened if I'd applied these principles I've been talking about, these principles of interfaith engagement with this woman? What would it have been like to have had a spiritual conversation, to go deeper with her, to understand why that question was so important, why my answer was so important? What about finding a moral vision together? I mean, she and I were at the same dinner to support the same nonprofit. Surely there was common ground there as to what world we both wanted to help come into existence, at least some characteristics of that world. we both shared in common. Surely I, as a universalist in the tradition of Origen, have enough love in my being to engage in such a conversation. This is the season where we have the opportunity, the invitation to engage in this kind of diplomacy, if just within our own lives. Across that holiday table at family gatherings that I talked about, we are often faced with people who have come to very different conclusions and perspectives than us on the same world around us. We struggle to connect, and too often anger is the place that we go. But I invite you to think about this process if you are faced with those times, to consider going deeper, to connecting on a level that encourages that other person, whoever they are, whether it's in your family or out in the community, to share from their place of ultimate concern. I encourage you to do this from your place of faith, again, however you interpret that. Origen said, "The power of choosing good or evil is within the reach of us all." And I will say that if that is so, then we must make a choice. For to not choose would be to let the opportunity to do good slip away. In Origen, the Christian church had its first theologian. His teaching was not merely theoretical, but also imbued with an intense ethical power, one that can speak to we Unitarian Universalists even today. Centuries later, his very name was stricken from the books of the church. Yet in the monasteries of the Greeks, his influence still lives on, known as the spiritual father of Greek monasticism. And we may never truly be able to cross all the divisions in the humanity that surrounds us. Maybe not. But we will certainly not do so if we don't try. I encourage you to begin trying this holiday season. We owe it to the possibilities of the new year ahead. Those possibilities remain unwritten, unknown, waiting for us to simply invite them in. Let them in. May you let those possibilities in this holiday season.